Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl. And with us today, I think our most common guest.
Are we going to have to get him a jacket soon? This is probably his fourth time.
This is his fifth.
I don't know. Fifth, we got to get him a fifth jacket. That's what
he's technically my chief science officer, but I may change it to chief sex officer.
Dr. Grant.
I thought you were going to say maybe chief sexy officer.
Yeah.
Slight difference with that one letter.
Straight up sex officer. Okay, fair enough. Whatever.
Anyway, Dr. Grant Tinsley, he's a renowned body composition expert, which is why I wanted him, which was why I hired him, because our niche of research that we do in our clinic, and we'll probably get my brother involved since he has a gym at his clinic, we wanted to kind of study the body composition effects. And if you've listened to all the podcasts that Dr. Grant's been on, it all started when our buddy, the Dr. Peter Attia Hater podcast, we call it, it's a half a joke, but made a comment on the Megyn Kelly show about one of his patients becoming, quote, fatter from taking one of these medicines because they lost so much muscle that it actually made their body fat percentage go up. And we had a laugh about how it's just anecdotal, and we actually went over the data. Anyway, we brought him on today because we did actually a case series with a few of our patients, and we actually set up a prospective cohort study with our telemedicine program. So today we're just going to go over the results of our case series. So thanks for coming back on the podcast, Dr. Tinsley.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure chatting with both of you. And I appreciate our, you know, we go from button up, for those watching, button up to t-shirt to barely having a shirt on.
Yeah.
Over here with Dr. Carl.
I got my workout in this morning. Days off, going to go sailing later. I'm
That's great.
So, okay, my brother doesn't really know a ton about this, but why don't you go ahead and discuss, you know, what a case series is? Because honestly, you know, when you talk about anecdotes of like Peter Attia, we're actually now collecting anecdotes, and we'll go over the basically, I saw some questions when you posted kind of a reel yesterday about it on Instagram. Were there any sex differences, and what are the limitations of a case series versus cohort versus a randomized trial? So maybe you can kind of go over that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, just to set the stage here, kind of our motivation in looking at this is that there were amazing patients out there who are keeping meticulous records about what they're doing throughout their obesity treatment, throughout their weight loss journey, more detail than we can even include in this case series that we're going to talk about. But there's this amazing data out there. And essentially what we did is got IRB approval and of course consent from these participants to be able to use the data that they've collected carefully over months and years. And a kind of key component of this is that there was objective testing. So of course we had some questionnaires that we'll talk about with, you know, nutrition and exercise. But each of the three individuals included in this case series had just fee for service local DEXA testing. So they had serial DEXA scans throughout their treatment at one specific facility. I was able to review these reports individually to ensure that they're valid. Again, same facility controls for a lot of errors we might see if someone's kind of like popping around to different assessment devices or different DEXA clinics. But we had some good stability there. But again, our rationale is we are running this prospective trial, but it takes a long time. So, I mean, we're, you know, getting deeper into it, but it's a long time when we have a few people with really, you know, several years of very interesting data. We were wanting to just take a look at that. And I mean, as you know, we accepted anyone who had the information. This was not us like sifting around trying to find the three best cases. It's like the people who had this information, we analyzed all their data, we wrote it up. So in that sense, it was not, you know, sifting through trying to promote any narrative, just everyone that we could get. We wrote these up in detail. So really any more than three cases, this would get very long. But point being, we have three cases, two females who are both 42 at baseline and a male who's 52 at baseline, and have data from, I believe, 39 to 139 weeks across the three patients. So I'll pause there if there's any more background we want to set. But again, the point here is to just in detail characterize these kind of almost individual patient stories from the data perspective on what they did lifestyle wise, what their actual medication use was, how that was titrated and so on, and some nutritional information as well.
Well, let's go over just a little bit of the background for people. We're mostly talking in this case, I assume, we're talking about GLP-1 receptor agonists or the dual agonist tirzepatide, right? And I don't know, do any of the three have only one versus any other one, or are they all the same?
No, that's correct. So one of the patients was on semaglutide the whole way. One was on tirzepatide the whole way. And one did a switch, actually. Started on semaglutide and then switched to tirzepatide.
Okay. Well, so for people out there, I mean, these types of medications go back well over 20 years. I mean, the research has been going on for 30, 40 years. But the first one of these GLP-1 receptor agonists, exenatide, was approved in 2005 for type 2 diabetes. And they kept getting better and better for type 2 diabetes, blood sugar control, weight loss, cardiovascular outcomes, and beyond. And then eventually we got to this point where we have Ozempic and Wegovy, which is semaglutide, Mounjaro and Zepbound, which is tirzepatide. And they have the most robust weight loss of any medications we've ever had before. But what anytime anybody loses weight through diet, we'll put exercise aside a second, but through diet, medications, surgery, all of these things working together, there is a certain amount of percentage loss that is fat, but also non-fat mass, right? Lean mass you talk about, and some of that being muscle mass loss. And we've had you try to go over some of the studies that have been published, or at least small parts of some of the big studies that have been published, suggesting, like in the case of Wegovy, maybe a little bit more fat-free mass loss than what would have been expected, except that you nicely went through how that's kind of because of all the little nuanced confounders within our bodies that are measured by DEXA. And then the tirzepatide study really was more consistent with, like, I think the bariatric surgery studies anyways. But our big thing is, how much can lifestyle, specifically exercise, more specifically probably strength training, in addition to protein and whatnot, mitigate some of that so we can optimize everyone's muscle, because muscle is also very important for health. And that's kind of the background, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as mentioned, if we're looking at, and for the purpose of our conversation, fat-free mass and then lean soft tissue, which is what we're actually looking at here from DEXA, they're similar. The only difference here is the bone mineral. So we've had the other episodes where we dive into that in detail. But yeah, the context here, like you said, is that, across these different medications, on average, the percent that was coming from, let's say, lean soft tissue was in the range of about 26 to 40%, with the lower end of that 26% being tirzepatide, higher end being semaglutide. Of course, that's on average. So we know we have a lot of variability around there. There are some people who have lower lean soft tissue loss, some who have higher. So that is where it's interesting to look at these individual patients, not to overinterpret what we see here, but to look at these individual patients, compare what they were doing lifestyle-wise to what was done in these previous trials, and then compare things like how much of their weight loss came from lean soft tissue, and just compare it to those benchmarks we've seen in the larger trials.
Why don't you go over what these individuals did? So the other thing, I want to make a caveat. This is a selection bias. We didn't actually go and cherry pick these people, but like when you think about the people that will meticulously go and do this type of thing and really get into it, I don't want to be like, yeah, anybody that just kind of does a diet and exercise that we think is optimal. We believe this is the case. However, these three individuals were really into it. I know them. They work extremely hard. Probably they exercise, I think, more than I do. So,
what can be, at least, and what
we wanted to showcase what could happen if you do this
we're going to have to talk about, for people out there, the hierarchy of where, you know, these come in line with scientific evidence, right? So, you know, you got your anecdotes from Peter Attia, and then, you know, and then you have case studies, and then, you know, prospective cohort studies, and then randomized clinical trials. We already have, but we don't have them with what we want, with the strength training component and all that stuff, and then meta-analyses. And Grant probably would be better than we could ever be at explaining that. But as you go
Yeah, I mean, you just stepped up that ladder very, very nicely. But yeah, I think there is some merit when we don't have the studies you want here yet. I think there's some merit in looking at these individual patient stories. There's some more detail you can go into than when you're looking at a randomized controlled trial. You're trying to standardize everything. Some of the details we'll get into here that I appreciate is the patient's just reporting what they did nutritionally. So people saying, you know, I was following intuitive eating, or I didn't restrict any foods per se, but I was trying to emphasize protein and fiber, and just almost this narrative, a little bit more of a personal narrative. So I think it can be very useful. But yeah, absolutely, this is demonstrating what is potentially possible in some people who really lean into this. Definitely not presenting this as saying like, oh, you know, just lift some weights and do XYZ and you won't lose any lean soft tissue. That's certainly not what we're saying here.
Cool. But they show, what were they doing?
Yeah, so I'll run through. Do you want me to just run through each one individually?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so as mentioned, two of the individuals at baseline were 42-year-old females. So the first individual in terms of I won't go through all the numbers. If you want all the numbers, they're in the case series. And just to clarify for everyone, this is posted online. This is a preprint, meaning that it's currently undergoing peer review, but we wanted to share these results sooner. With that said, this is very descriptive data. I mean, they sent us the data. We present the data exactly. This is not like we're going to change our statistical analysis, because really it's just presenting all the data as is. So, you know, we don't expect these numbers to change at all unless, say, we receive additional data from the participants. But the first participant on the nutrition side reported, and again, I think this is useful to know, not following a specific nutrition program, but emphasizing protein and fiber intake, the typical energy intake that was reported from all the information we gathered was in the range of 1600 to 1800 calories a day. Again, it just fairly balanced macronutrient distribution, in that nothing was, you know, intentionally completely cut out. Very normal meal frequency, so about 4 separate eating occasions per day over 12 to 13 hours a day. So no prolonged fasting, no super high meal frequency or super low meal frequency. There was some dietary supplementation that was fairly straightforward. Now on the exercise side, and I think this was helpful because we quantified kind of their vocational physical activity and then all the outside activities. And we also had a very specific muscle strengthening questionnaire we looked at. So I won't go into all the details today, but we have it split into, like, you know, the specific frequency and duration of body weight exercise and resistance exercise with weights or bands and all these other types. But this patient reported very light vocational physical activity. That was primarily like sitting or standing desk work. But she performed intentional exercise or structured physical activity 5 to 6 days a week across a variety of types. So again, we're very pro lifting here. I think the resistance training stimulus, the amount of mechanical loading you get, it's really hard to argue with its benefits here. But we see a whole variety of types of physical activity. So walking, biking, jogging, some resistance training there, progressing into things like trail races, you know, as this individual went on. So again, this is not someone who's just locked in the gym with the iron only, but they're finding a variety of ways to move. So on the resistance training frequency, I'm scanning through the different types. It was typically around 3 days a week. I see bodyweight exercises 3 days a week with resistance and free weights. And those were likely combined in the same session. We have details in here. Essentially, they targeted all major muscle groups. So, you know, again, this is, there's some more detail in the case series, but over the 115 weeks of data we had for this individual from their baseline scan to the last scan, body mass decreased by 33%. So lost a third of body mass. The body fat percentage for this individual at baseline was over 56% body fat, and that decreased down to 39% at the end. So ultimately, when we're looking at something like the percent of weight loss from lean soft tissue, only about 9% of weight loss was lean soft tissue, and over 90% was fat mass. So again, if we compare that to that range of say 26 to potentially up to 40% coming as lean soft tissue on average in these other trials, having less than 10% of weight loss as lean soft tissue is pretty fantastic.
That's incredible. Did we get a range of approximately how much protein per kilograms of weight?
Yes. Let me look. I'm just scanning through. There are a lot of numbers we had here. Let's see. I have the absolute intake, which I did calculate the relative intakes. So I know the numbers off the top of my head across all three patients, but I think this is an important point. We'll see each patient reported emphasizing dietary protein intake. But when we looked at the actual relative intakes across participants, they were as low as 0.8 grams per kilogram. So down at the RDA, up to about 1.7 grams per kilogram.
But that wasn't lean. You know, how we talk about protein per sort of estimated lean body mass versus just mass.
Right? Correct. Yeah. So we discussed that briefly without diving into a lot, saying there are some limitations to taking something like a generic gram per kilogram body mass recommendation and applying it in this context. So yes, that is a great point. That 0.8 grams per kilogram of body mass, you know, at a high body mass and relatively high body fat could be, you know, a sufficient intake.
Now, for this patient and all the patients, what were their baseline obesity-related disease states? Type 2 diabetes, fatty liver, sleep apnea, heart disease, PCOS, dyslipidemia, blood pressure, any of those things?
So we did not go into extensive detail on that portion. We have characterized their baseline body composition, of course, that they were diagnosed with obesity, being treated for obesity. We have a little bit of medical background related in this case to like a hysterectomy and hormone replacement therapy, some information about perimenopause and so on, but largely focus just on the more concrete data we had from the first DEXA scan to the last scan, along with the self-reported nutrition and exercise during that time period.
Do we know her other medications other than, was she a semaglutide or tirzepatide one?
She was, let me make sure I don't tell you wrong here, tirzepatide.
Okay. And then she was on menopausal hormone therapy. Do you know if she was on any other medications at all?
I do not off the top of my head.
We were limited in words. So that was like part of the whole thing with word count and figuring out what to put in here. Cause like, you know, things like, would type 2 diabetes play a role? I know people were going to ask about menopausal hormonal therapy, and we thought that would be a very smart thing to put in there. I know these individuals. I don't know if I'm allowed to really say.
I mean, it does a big deal if they have type 2 diabetes and are on, you know, whatever other diabetes medications or, you know, blood pressure meds and stuff, if you know that.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to make sure.
And that's a great, so this is a, I'll do a tangent. This is a nice thing about preprints is part of it is getting this type of feedback. So, you know, if we're getting feedback, it's like, this is really essential. We'd of course double check. We have the HIPAA authorization forms from every participant granting us, you know, permission to use the relevant background information. But that may be an example of something we could incorporate.
A little bit of hyperlipidemia.
Yeah, so do you want me to roll into the second case here?
Yeah, go.
Okay. So second case, interestingly enough, at baseline was also a 42-year-old woman.
Coincidence, by the way.
Yeah, coincidence. So this participant is very interesting because she had the shortest treatment duration, but some of the most, you know, amazing. I'm trying to think of some more sciencey way to say amazing results. So she was treated with semaglutide. She had a baseline BMI of around 43, baseline body fat percentage of around 45%. This is a patient who reported following an intuitive eating program over this 39 weeks. So it's just 39 weeks from the baseline to the final scan, and we'll discuss those changes. And we actually show this patient's DEXA scans, the DEXA images, as a figure that's posted with that preprint. And it's pretty incredible. It's some of the most amazing transformation I've seen in a lot of years of studying body composition.
How about one of the most substantial clinical responses you've seen?
Yes, there we go. Yes. So she did report, and this is a patient who's very, very detailed on everything. She had a goal intake of 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram of body mass per day of protein, also emphasizing fiber and water consumption. Again, typical eating frequency, 4 meals a day over about 12 and a half hours. So nothing super out of the ordinary there. She provided some good detail to contextualize her vocational physical activity. She said was very light. Typically, she'd get about 3,000 steps a day in the absence of any intentional exercise. She had a goal during treatment of getting to 10 to 12,000 steps a day. She engaged in some form of intentional physical activity or structured exercise 7 days a week. So, I mean, substantial commitment. We're talking about over 2 hours a week of cycling classes, high-intensity functional training classes 5 days a week. And then we detail some, you know, what that includes on the resistance training components. But over this 39 weeks, she decreased about 27% weight loss. So about 27% weight loss, got the BMI down to 31. What's amazing. So again, her baseline body fat percentage was 45.4%. That was down to 23.8% after 39 weeks. And this is one where her fat mass loss from DEXA actually exceeded her weight loss. So what that means is she gained a small amount, not a lot, but about a kilogram of lean soft tissue while losing, I mean, it was over 60% of her baseline fat mass she lost. So about 27 kilograms of fat mass loss while gaining about 1 kilogram of lean soft tissue in 39
her
weeks.
Her DEXA was like, I was like, geez, what is...
It's one of those things, if I wasn't looking at the reports myself, I'd be like, no, that can't be right. But I'm looking at the reports, I'm looking at the images, looking at the data, and it's just incredible.
That's a great anecdote. That's
yeah.
Yeah. And again, substantial commitment. I mean, seven days a week, targeting the 10 to 12,000 steps, all the other components, the cycling, the classes. So a substantial effort from the participant here.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, far more than what we would really expect most patients to be. But it's amazing to see that it's in the realm of actual biological possibility.
Yeah.
And this one was semaglutide, right?
Correct. Yes.
So there you go. There you go, Peter.
There's our anecdote, Peter. Let's go on the Megyn Kelly show and say, well, I don't know. My patient gained muscle. So
let's whatever. I'd like to go on the Megyn Kelly show.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not the... Moving on.
Yeah, so our last case here, we do have a male for the question that we got online, that there was a male in this very, very small data set, 52-year-old male at baseline, baseline BMI of around 33, baseline body fat percentage of around 35%. Dr. Carl, this patient had a history of hyperlipidemia, and we have some information about the medication use there. This is the patient who started on semaglutide instead of semaglutide. I go back and forth on how I pronounce it, but semaglutide. And then after about 30 weeks, let's see, titrated over 12 weeks, approximately 30 weeks later, was switched to tirzepatide. But this is an individual who we ended up having, I think it was 139 weeks between the initial assessment. So we're getting, you know, to a duration that's a lot longer than some of these DEXA sub-studies, which is kind of another interesting component here. There are a lot of things I like about this case that are just, kind of real and transparent. So first, starting on the dietary side, they emphasize lean protein, so primarily chicken and fish, fresh fruits and vegetables, and non-fat or low-fat dairy. With some nuts and whole grains. Typical energy intake was around 2,400 calories a day. We have some more details there on the nutrition side. This was another individual whose self-reported vocational physical activity was very light. And I identify with that. I've been tracking my step counts more, and I it's abysmal how low they are unless I really try to increase it, you know, sitting at the desk. But this individual also reported a goal of exercising 5 to 6 days a week, but saying that frequency was often reduced down to 3 days a week due to business travel. So I just appreciated that kind of the real life glimpses we get there. With that said, go ahead.
I was just going to say that sounds like what I tell my patients, like, yeah, let's make a goal of 5-6 days a week, but we know that's not always going to happen when life hits you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So what they overall though, what this patient was performing was got up to running 5 to 7 miles per week across 2 to 3 sessions, and resistance training 3 days a week, primarily with basic powerlifting techniques. So there's some details there again, because we teased it out on the resistance training component, but about 3 days a week of resistance training. So this one was interesting. Again, the body mass loss as a percentage was less dramatic than the other two. It's still 13% body mass loss. The BMI got down to 28.5. Body fat percentage. So again, we were starting at 35% body fat. This individual got down to about 21% body fat. But this was another case. So this individual actually gained from the most recent scan we got almost 4 kilograms of lean soft tissue from baseline to the final assessment. And during that time lost 17.5 kilograms of fat mass. So again, longer duration, you know, in a sense, slower rate of weight loss, but very, very positive body composition changes here.
Hyperlipidemia, looks like lipid lowering therapies. So kind of interesting. I think what people are going to ask, and we need to get a randomized trial. There was a trial that, again, we got beat out in our grant. It looks like the other, huh?
We tried.
So another, it looks like it's going to be published soon, the T-Rex study with tirzepatide and resistance training. Maybe Grant knows the guy that, and maybe we can get him on here to talk about it. So that study should be coming out. We saw preliminary data. It looked like a massive improvement in fat-free mass or lean soft tissue retention. I don't know what they measured or how they did it. So it looks good there. We have we're doing our cohort study, but you know, what will happen in a postmenopausal, non-menopausal hormonal therapy taking type 2 diabetes patient? All these things, which is why we need more trials. And you know what? Grant's going to run them. We're going to make him do it. We're going to make him. And we're probably going to recruit for all this stuff in the future. It's all future planning. But my brother does have a gym, so we're going to run.
Yeah. We can get the, I think we know the owners of all these gym chains. Maybe we can get them to fund it. They got some money. We know them. You know,
someone's got some money.
Anyway,
yeah.
Quick question for you. And this is kind of a, an old gym bro thing that's truly data driven, I think. The whole newbie response, right? So people who, we're not going to gain much more muscle. You know, we probably maxed out a long time ago. And so if we start cutting weight, it would take a huge effort to retain muscle and not going to gain any muscle. But people who haven't done a lot of strength training or any in their life and start doing it, even if they're losing weight at the same time, are they going to be the ones who are going to have the highest chance of maybe gaining muscle despite being in an energy deficit and weight loss, regardless of meds or whatever?
I would think yes. And just to connect it to this, we do not have a prior history of resistance training. We essentially have the information. We're asking for everything that was done during treatment. So that's an interesting question. It would be nice to know more about their background prior to this. But just as a general question, yes, I would expect those that might be able to potentially get a small increase in lean soft tissue. And we're inferring, I won't restate everything you said on other podcasts, but the lean soft tissue is not directly skeletal muscle. Still, this is, a favorable indicator, and it's what we have to work with in this data set. But yes, I would expect those with, who are essentially resistance training naive to have the highest chance to gain lean soft tissue or muscle mass during weight loss.
Grant, are you an expert in this? We talk about this a lot, but there's some people out there pushing the idea that protein intake is more important than resistance training. And the argument is like, well, if you don't eat any protein, it's going like this false dichotomy, but we know practically people, it's almost impossible to not eat any protein during the day. So like, if you took a person with a relatively low amount of protein intake and had them eat more protein versus taking another person with a very low protein intake and randomizing them to resistance training, which one's going to do better?
Resistance training, for sure. Yeah. Especially if you're thinking overall health, for sure resistance training. But even just purely on the body comp side, I would be floored if the protein performed better than the resistance training. I think the mechanical loading is just too essential here. There is quite a range of protein intakes that can accommodate, muscle gain with resistance training. And like you said, practically there would be some exceptions, I'm sure, but practically most people are not getting such low protein intake that they're unable to adapt positively to an exercise stimulus.
Yeah. Very good.
Consistent with all the evidence we've ever seen in our lives, and yet we have these people, and maybe it's just because they're trying to sell protein powders.
Yeah, some of them, doctors even.
We used to sell, you know, some protein powder, but we never made such crazy claims, so I guess that's why it didn't work.
I love a good protein powder, not going to lie.
No, I do too. But yeah, if you're putting them head to head, and obviously ideally we'd have both. We'd be hitting the if you want this and that. Yeah. But when you get down to it, like if there's one message that needs to be pushed, I think it's on the exercise side.
Absolutely.
I'm so proud of I'm just so proud of some of these patients where, you know, that's why people are like, oh, they just need to exercise more. I'm like, some of my patients exercise more than I do. I watch them. I watch their Instagrams. I'm like, holy cow, they do almost like twice the amount of volume that I do. It's really cool to see.
You know, with us, there's a lot of luck involved in life, right? You know, raised, we've done this since we were little kids. And so we had that foundation literally consistently for our whole lives. And, you know, so that's a little bit of luck on our side to help kind of maintain this stuff. But yeah, I have a ton of patients who they're working their butts off.
Yeah. My brother had abs in utero. He was doing pull-ups on his umbilical cord. He was doing rows, pretty much doing bench press. And there he came out with pecs and lats. Oh, it never gets old. Anyway, thanks for coming on and explain that. You know, it would be nice if we had some kind of preliminary data here soon from our cohort. Maybe you can come on. Maybe we can do a preliminary analysis of something once we're done kind of recruiting, maybe a baseline DEXA of all the participants. So we'll think of some different ideas. But
yeah, we'll have those. We'll have the hand grip. So we're doing hand grip. The next assessment after baseline is 3 months. So we are accumulating at that 3 month time point a good number of people who have passed that mark and submitted the hand grip test, which that will be nice because what we talked about here is body comp and their performance probably was doing great with the level of exercise and physical activity. But that's kind of a missing point in a lot of these DEXA sub-studies is some function, even if it's as simple as a hand grip or some simple, you know, functional test.
Yeah.
Do hand grips on both hands?
Yeah, and triplicate on both hands at each time point. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Spencer and I have like triple the strength on our right hands than our left.
I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, we have some participants will send in their values, and I ask them to confirm if they're right or left-handed. And you know, sometimes it's kind of laughable because there is this huge disparity. But sometimes you'll have the people where their non-dominant hand, you know, for whatever reason, it's a little stronger.
Yeah, pitch hitting, or what do you call that? All right. Well, thanks for coming on. If you have friends, family, anybody that would benefit from knowing what the optimal weight is possible when it comes to body composition, make sure you, with these medicines and exercise and protein and all that, make sure you share this with them. Give us a good review, all that type of stuff. If you want to give us a bad review, go to hell. I'm just kidding. Anyway. All right. Here is our outro. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Tinsley.
Absolutely.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.